For more than two decades, activist and author Bruce O'Hara has explored the world of work with his books Working Harder Isn't Working and Put Work in Its Place. He also founded Work Well, Canada's first work option resource center, which helps promote arrangements to reduce and restructure work times. He most recently has been focusing on rethinking and redefining our concept of retirement. He's here today to talk to us about his latest book, Enough Already, which focuses on midlife and the opportunities it offers us to create a more simple and balanced lifestyle. Thank you so much, Bruce, for joining us. So I want to hear you begin to tell us what you would describe as the traditional retirement that you're advocating we move away from.
I think our traditional model of retirement, I mean, I basically have trouble with all parts of our model of retirement. I mean, one thing is that it starts all at once. It usually doesn't come until you're 65. And traditional retirement seems to have a lot of retreat into it, that you kind of, you have no responsibilities in the world, no work, no challenge. You just go lay on the beach all day and relax and play cards. And it's not that doing all of those things isn't nice some of the time, but it's not enough to actually make a life for people. That when you talk to seniors, you find that the happy seniors do anything but that sort of stuff, and the healthy ones too, for that matter.
Okay, so the idea of like just being on vacation for the rest of your life isn't necessarily the answer for most people.
It doesn't seem to be, in terms of, again, there's now a really good body of research on the general title, they call it, is successful aging. And people who've looked at seniors will tell you there's a pool of seniors who, the happiest seniors, tend to live 10 or 20 years longer than the rest of the senior population and are healthier as well as living longer. And that group of seniors do not do retirement in any kind of traditional way, generally.
Can you explain what are some of the assumptions we make about retirement that we think of as freedom but really aren't?
Well, I think one assumption is that you never have to work again. And it's true, you never have to work again. But for a lot of people, that becomes, I never can work again. And let's face it, for a lot of us, work is where we get challenged. Work is where we learn new stuff. Work is how we get connected to other people. There are ways in which work gives us a whole lot. What I think is the real freedom of retirement is that we no longer have to work for money. We can work for money, but there's also a whole slew of jobs out there where we can work for love, where we can work because it's something we're passionately interested in. And to give up the idea of working just because you don't have to work for money anymore is really throwing out the baby with the bathwater. It's giving up a huge amount of your freedom.
I also assume that there are people who don't save very well, a lot of people in this country, who actually financially need to continue to work.
There are, and I think for a lot of those people, one of the issues is to say, how do you find ways to have work fit in your life where it's there as something that adds to your life but doesn't take it over or exhaust you? I would agree there are quite a few people these days where whom not only is traditional retirement not something they'd want to do, it's something they can't afford to do. And there I think the issue is how do you set up a life for yourself that has balance and some variety, some novelty into it, to not always do the same thing you've always done.
Right. So give us a picture of what your alternative model for living the second half of our lives, or how we could do it differently.
Well, I think that fundamentally there's two kind of imbalances in the North American lifestyle as I see it. One is that most North Americans are very wasteful in their spending habits and have a lot of unconsciousness. So we burn through a huge amount of money, and then the flip side of that is we work obsessively, we work 45 and 65 with your whole life being based on work, and then you turn 65, start collecting your pension and your Social Security if you've got them, and all of a sudden you have no job and you have no life, well, who are you? I would argue that once you hit 45, if your kids have left home, hopefully if your mortgage is paid off, you at that point have the opportunity, if you're willing, to look at your relationship with money, to work less than full-time, get a life then, broaden yourself then, start doing a lot of the things that we think of as coming with retirement. You don't have to wait till you're 65. And a lot of them, I think they're better if you do them early.
Like, give us examples of what kind of things you think people should start doing at 45, not wait till they're 65.
Okay. Well, I'm 54, and for me, one of the things that really shifted me is last year my youngest brother died of pancreatic cancer. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened again when I was there nursing him in his last month, he was always going to come out to British Columbia where I live, and I was going to show him around. And we'd always had that on the list. We're going to do that someday.
Mm.
And I can remember being with him when that subject came up again. And, oh, yeah, we were always going to do that. And we both looked at each other, and we know, it's not going to happen, is it?
Mm.
And that, for me, just really brought it home to me, is that none of us knows how many somedays we've got. And one of the things I'd always told myself is, you know, I'd really love to go teach English overseas. Out of China is a place I've always been fascinated by. And so I think that was one of the things that pushed me to just say, well, this is a someday. Today mm-hmm. is a someday I know, but I'm going to China.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I did in March. I went off to China, and I taught English at a university, and it was an absolutely wonderful adventure. I think those are the kind of things that you can do now. You don't have to wait till later. And in fact, there are ways in which if you do it when you're 55, there's more doors open to you than if you wait till you're 65 or 70. For me, what is also true now is because I'm now an experienced ESL teacher, probably up until the time I'm 75, I can go anywhere in the world and teach English. I mean, the next place adventure I've set up for myself starts next week in Ecuador. Teaching at a school there. And for me, that's the kind of thing that you're free to do once you unhook yourself from that full-time rat race, and once you start to say, I am not going to let the traditional consumerist American lifestyle decide how my time is going to be spent.
Tell us about the idea I've heard you talk about where you say if you don't use it, you'll lose it. What kind of examples can you give us about that as we age?
That's true in almost anything you can name. I think there's part of it is physiology, that your body is such that any part of your body you don't use, whether you're talking about your sexuality or your muscles or your brain, it will atrophy if it doesn't get used. Part of it, I think, is also courage, that one of the traps of retirement is you don't have to do anything. And what it means is that if you start to get scared of the world, you can spend all your time in front of the TV, essentially bored, but too afraid to do anything else. And I think it is very dangerous to not see that the real excitement of life comes on stuff that's new, that's around the edges of what, oh, maybe I can only just barely do this. I mean, that's the edge that has fun. I mean, if you're too far beyond, I can't do this at all, then it gets terrifying. But the really adventure part of life is on the edge, where it's stuff that's still new to you, still a challenge. And if you don't live on that edge, you start to lose your ability to do so. You become more and more afraid. Your circle of friendships gets smaller. Your circle of things where you say, I'm confident at this, gets smaller. Even your physical abilities get smaller over time.
That's so interesting. I never really thought about courage as a muscle that you have to keep using. We hear a lot about your body and your brain, but that kind of essence of just taking chances isn't something you hear about often.
It's not, but it remains true nonetheless. And I think partly it's something we don't focus on because our culture doesn't expect seniors to show courage. But when you look at it, the seniors we most respect and the seniors that we most envy usually do that. They continue to learn new things and challenge themselves. And it is, I think for many of them, an act of conscious courage.
Right. I feel like one thing I need is to see people older than myself as and ones that I admire and have them be role models, because we don't necessarily get to see a lot of options for our future. And I wonder, what kind of research is there about happiness in elderly people or in senior citizens? I mean, what does the research say makes people happiest?
Well, actually, there's two pieces of research there. One that was interesting to me recently that just came out in the last couple of months is that when you look at the question of happiness, both young people and old people think young people should be happiest. Mm-hmm. But when you actually check it out, up until the age of about 75, people tend to get happier as they get older. They often think, oh, I must be different or exceptional. And that's, I guess, how they explain the idea that young people should be happier, but I myself happen to be happier. And that the limiting factor in terms of age is usually about 75. Either the person will lose a spouse or their health, and those two things can tip the balance. But up until that point, your expectation should be that you'll get happier as you get older, and that seems to be partly that we learn some equanimity about the changes in the world and some ability to live with ourselves and live and manage our own emotions. I think the three kind of issues that have the most potency to create happiness for people are connection, is to find ways to establish a circle for yourself of friends, relationships with family, any way that you connect with people. I think one of the ways we connect with people best is through things that we love, whether it's dance or reading or learning, whatever it is that you love. That's often the big way you connect with people best, or your community. The second issue I think that is really important for people is some sense of purpose. You know, what am I here for? What am I good at? What am I useful in? That if you don't have that sense of competence and value in the world, I think it's very hard for most people to have a solid sense of worth without that. And I think the third thing for people that has a really good track record in making them happy is any kind of challenge, something that stretches you, pushes you to keep learning, pushes you to be on the edge of new, where, I mean, well, let's see, with children, you love watching children because everything is an adventure to them and everything is new to them. Well, you can have that as an adult. You just have to go to newer places to create that as an adult. Whereas a kid, pretty well anywhere they are is new to them. As an adult, you still have that opportunity, but you have to go create your challenges. You have to create your newness to get that aliveness that comes from living on the edge between what you know and what you don't know.
Mm-hmm. And you really think that these are skills that require practice, that you can't just start? I mean, for somebody who's 65 saying, you know, I've built my whole life towards retirement, and now I'm going to learn those skills to enjoy the rest of my life. You feel like that it's the practice is really important?
There are people who do it. You can do it. It's just not something, I would say, it's a high-risk strategy to wait till you're 65 to learn this stuff. It's a much easier road to hoe. I mean, I think when by the time people are 50, if your kids have grown up and your house is paid off, you have got a lot of freedom to start arranging your life the way you want it and to start setting up the rest of your life. And I think these kind of skills, any kind of skill, practice helps with it. And it's also true that whatever we're talking about, if we're talking about volunteering in Africa or teaching English in China or becoming a ballroom dancer. If you've got some experience with taking on those challenges when you're 50 or 60, it's a lot easier to imagine you're doing them when you're 70. I think practice is a value. And again, I wouldn't say that you can't do it starting all at once at 65. I would say it's high risk, that for a lot of people it just becomes so overwhelming that they shut down and live the rest of their life in front of the television. And it's not often not a long life anyway. So, I mean, that's one of the things that we've seen about the retreat model of retirement, is that it tends to very much shorten your lifespan and make you much more likely to become senile early.
Uh-huh. Right. It seems like loneliness and the feeling of uselessness would really contribute to isolation and not, you know, all the syndrome you're talking about.
Yeah, it really drains vitality from the body, and I think it is possible for everyone to look around and see models of both what they don't want to do and what they do want to do. And I think that's another thing that's useful to do when you're 50, is to start to look around at the older people around you, and you can see. And the other thing I would advise everyone to do is to be impolite enough to ask people their age more often. Because I think we all have an internal clock that says, oh, this is what 65 looks, this is what 75 looks like, this is what 85 looks like. And one of the things I really noticed when I started doing research for my book is that the people who are most alive as seniors, who had all that purpose, connection, and challenge, I routinely underestimated their age by 10 to 20 years. I thought, oh, they're only 65. And I was like, you're 82? Oh, my God.
I guess that's...
How do you do that? What happens when you're really alive is, I think it keeps your body much younger, and it keeps your mind much younger.
And it's this whole thing of, like, the new 50, the new 65. I guess what that's really about is that people that stay young and vital in spirit look and feel younger.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's very much obvious when you look at the research on aging is at 40, our health profiles are relatively close together. At 80, they're right across the board. I mean, you've got 80-year-olds who really don't have a health profile much different from 50-year-olds, and then you've got 80-year-olds who are senile and falling apart in every aspect, or they're already dead. You know, it's like... by 80, we're incredibly different, and a lot of that differentness is the attitude you live with.
And does research connect the attitude with actual longevity or health problems?
Absolutely. I mean, I think it was George Bellant, it was one of the Harvard groups, and he actually went through and made quadrants where he looked at the happy, well group and the unhappy, sick group, and he found very definite correlates. Both, first of all, that happy and well tended to go together, and unhappy and sick went together, but there were very definite correlates in terms of attitude and behavior that made it much more likely you would be in the happy, well group. That this stuff is not stuff that's just anecdotal, that science has gone a fair way to tie it down. I mean, there's books like, they all have similar names. There's Aging with Grace, Successful Aging, the other one's Aging Well, that all of them are scientific studies that have looked at this connection between attitude and behavior and aging and found a very strong relationship.
I love how you talk about changing the concept of midlife crisis into a midlife opportunity. Along those lines, I wonder if you could tell us some ways, and even if we've covered them, to help us summarize ways that we can experience the joys of retirement more.
Now?
Sure.
Like at 50?
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, I think one of the things that is useful a couple of things to do. One of the things I think it can be useful for people, if you've been in one job for a long time, if you're one of those fortunate and unfortunate people who's had the same job for 20 or 25 years, I think it can be really useful for people to take a half-time break. Put in it with your employer to take 6 months or a year off and do one of those things that you've always said you'll do someday, that you wanted to do, whether it's volunteer in Africa or go across the canals of Europe. Because I think one of the things that happens is if you've been stuck in that 50-hour-week rat race for a long time, you're so head down, you don't really have much ability to look around or think about even really, what do I want for the rest of my life? So I think it is useful to find a way to just unplug for 6 or 12 months. And I think it's also useful in that to do something that's not too busy. You know, but if you're going to go tour the canals of Europe, don't make it a rush trip. Make it slow. If you're going to volunteer somewhere, don't pick one where you've got a job that takes all of your energy. Do something where you actually have time to be in yourself in a different life.
So to experience a different pace of life.
A different pace of life and a different reality. And I think it that can be a really subversive step for a lot of people. I know quite a few people who've gone off and done that and just not been able to go back to their own life. And once they get over the transition of that, because that can be traumatic to know that you can't go back to your own life, once they get over the transition of that, be very grateful that that happened to them, because they can then create a new life for themselves. I think it's useful to think about, well, what is it that I would like to do in retirement, and start to do those things now. And for many people, the first step in that is to say, I need to get work in its place in my life. If work has taken up 50 or 60 hours of my week, I don't have time to have a full life. I don't have time to be a citizen, a neighbor, a friend. I don't have time to learn to be a good ballroom dancer, because that's something I've always said that I do someday. So I think that's an important piece of it, is to say, first of all, I probably need to look at my relationship with money so that money doesn't become the tail that wags the dog. And then I need to use the opportunity I think most of us have at midlife. For most people, there is a window there where they could live on less than a full-time income if they don't sort of go on automatic pilot. I mean, there's the Murphy Law that income will always rise until it, or expenses will always rise until they exceed income. But it's not something you can't override with some consciousness. If you start to say, I'm approaching a time where my kids are leaving home, I've finished paying for their schooling, I've made the last payment on the mortgage, all of a sudden my expenses have dropped by $600 or $2,000 a month, whatever it is, that's that many hours of my time that I wouldn't necessarily have to work. How could I do that? What would that look like in my life? What would I do with that time? And I think for a lot of people, the act of establishing a life with balance, where there is both work and play, becomes a really good model for the rest of their life. Because I think what you'll find is the most happy seniors, it's not like they are workaholic. They have lots of play in their life and kind of varied play, but they have enough work where they feel challenged, where they feel useful, where they feel like they're learning, that it does give them that sense of balanced life. And I said, well, why wait until you're 65 to do that? That the real opportunity for that begins once your primary parenting responsibilities start to come to an end.
So tell us, Bruce, what your plans are for your balanced retirement.
At this point, I'm having to do this very much one step at a time. As I say, when I started this year on the adventure of teaching English overseas, and right now I'm enjoying that so much, I don't know what comes after it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm having to say, this is where I am now. This is what I really want to do now. I mean, I know somewhere down the line, both music and dance are going to take up more of my time. I know that somewhere down the line, the realities of oil depletion start to hit. The world is going to have to look very differently at how we use energy and how we arrange our communities, and I want to be involved in the pioneering of that, not too far down the line. But at the moment, this new adventure for me of teaching English in other places is providing such a wonderful vehicle to see and learn about other cultures that it's taken my attention. And I think that's one of the other things that people need to recognize is that you don't necessarily plan the rest of your life. You have to say, what's got juice now? What is it that's my next step? Where is it that I want to go now? And trust that next step leads to the one beyond it. You know, I'm Capricorn. One of those signs is supposed to really like plans and planning ahead. So it's been a challenge for me to learn to just say, I can't say too much beyond now, because now involves steps that I don't know where they're going to lead. I mean, I may decide I like one of the countries that I go to visit enough that I have to figure out how life will happen in that country for all I know. The rest of my life will happen in that country. So
are these adventures really divergent from what you've been doing in your life?
I'm probably not a good example.
Okay.
I've always led a little bit an atypical life. And I suppose that was one of the reasons that, I mean, I wrote my book for me as much as anyone else.
Of course.
And that I looked ahead and I really didn't think traditional retirement was something I wanted to do, having not done a traditional work life.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's an important issue, though. There are a lot of people not doing the traditional work life anymore, and they need this kind of model for an untraditional retirement.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. Well, I wish you lots of luck. I hope you do come back so that we can talk to you again. Not that you'll be totally unreachable, but really, I hope you have happy and safe travels. And thanks for taking time to talk with me today.
My pleasure.
Okay. Take care, Bruce.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with author Bruce O'Hara about his latest book, Enough Already, which explores the alternatives to traditional retirement. I'd like to dedicate this program to my father, Burton Krumholtz, who's inspired me with his lifelong passion and commitment for his work, and by his refusal to let anything like retirement get in his way of doing what he loves most. Thanks for joining us for It's About Time. We welcome your comments and story ideas. Just email them to itsabouttimeradio@comcast.net. This show has been produced in association with Take Back Your Time, a national initiative challenging overwork, overscheduling, and time urgency. Find them at timeday.org. Join us every week for It's About Time on Thursday evenings at 6 o'clock, right here on WMUA 91.1 FM.